the more Christian I became, the greater the need for salvation came to my mind and to my soul. It did not give me a greater salvation for my mind. It gave me less.
Yeah. We're not going to take it anymore. I'll be right back. Can I say that again?
Webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment that you saw yourself and God and God and you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less than Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Judgment Day. I am not a Christian. Now that's good news. Ain't that good news? I'm not.
Welcome back to the Gospel Revolution Powercast with Mike Williams and Mike Williams Ministries. Tonight, Mike Williams continues to guide us through his new bestseller, One, The Gospel According to Mike. It is a bestseller. It sold better today than it did yesterday, and we're really proud of it. Tonight we've got the questions from the mailbag, we've got Moses Garter in the Kenyan Corner, we have Mike Williams, we've got Facebook updates, but most of all, we have you, our gospel revolutionaries listening in over 187 countries. Welcome aboard tonight, so sit back, get comfy, buckle up and enjoy the ride. I am your host, Beres Bartlett, coming to you from the Nashville studios of the Gospel Revolution, and we will be joined any moment by Mike Williams, the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution and Mike Williams Ministries.
It's all good news. It's all good news. I am not a Christian. It's all good news. It's all good news. I am not a Christian.
G'day, Mike. How you doing this week?
It's a good week. My goodness, it is a good week. There's been some trying things, but all in all, it honestly is a good week. It's been a good month. This has been an amazing month. It started out not so pleasant, having to do the funeral of my and our dear friend Richard Mull out in California. But as funerals go, it actually was a good one. We didn't have a bunch of religious things going on, and it was very respectful for Richard. But other than that, there's been a lot of really good turns of events. It's stuff I really wouldn't know how to explain it to anybody, but it's just those things that you wait for to watch some movement in, and suddenly there is. So, yeah, good week, good day. I'm having a good one. It's my birthday month. What else could it be?
Oh, yeah. Who's going to spoil that fun for you, mate?
Kids now, like I said, I started noticing more than a decade ago, it wasn't a birthday they had. It was a birthday week, so they would celebrate a whole week. Now, when talking with younger folks, they have a birthday month. So the moment it turns their birthday month, it's a party every weekend, every Saturday, every Sunday. They expect their friends to celebrate the whole month with them. So I don't know what you do if you get two or three friends born in the same month, but.
Well, this is the Beres year. I just decided it's the year.
Yes, and I support that 100%. The year of the Bartlett.
The year of the Bartlett. And my wife and I, we're celebrating our golden anniversary next month.
Oh, congratulations. That's wonderful. What day is that?
All the month,
yes.
Now, as you know, the golden wedding anniversary is where you've been married 50 years. I didn't say we'd been married 50 years. It's just we've been married 8 years, but I know that we're not going to make it to 50, so I figure why not just have the fun anyway and pay for it later.
And you're not talking about an imminent divorce, though, are you?
Heck no. I like this one. I think I'm going to keep it.
Well, the nice thing is that she'll keep you, you know?
Oh, you're not kidding. Mike, tonight we're going to be discussing your book, One, The Gospel According to Mike, and we're up into chapter 5. We're just powering ahead here like a tractor. And frankly, last week I found easy, but this week was a hard week for me as I read and reread and reread this chapter because there is really just so much in it. So what the heck? Let's just dig in and see where we go, shall we?
Let's dive.
Michael, where does the buck stop when it comes to the redemption of the world?
Well, the redemption of the world, of course, starts, stops, and everything in between with Jesus. He is the Redeemer. He is the Savior. Redemption and salvation are something that was done for us by God through Christ, and He is the one that we honor. Christianity does not honor Jesus. That's so difficult even yet for me to have to say, but when I start to deal with the truth about redemption in Christianity, I have to say Christianity does not honor Jesus.
So the buck stops when it comes to the redemption of the world with Jesus?
With Jesus.
Not us?
Well, thank God, not us. That would make us Christians now, wouldn't it?
Okay, then. Can we just for a moment put ourselves in the story as the one who's going to make it all happen? For the story's sake, we're God. If you or I were going to redeem the whole world and we are God, the invincible, God, the omnipotent, the universal spirit, the creator, why should we do such a sloppy job as to have our best play and our greatest achievement ever gets so mangled in the telling that 2,000 years later, the world is still missing our whole point or God's whole point? Did our PR department screw up? Did we, God, screw up? In short, if we're so capable that we got the job done, out of God and mankind, we created a brand new species, a God-man, which was our plan right from the start, then how did we fail so miserably at explaining it better so as to avoid the mental mayhem that we now call Christianity?
Well, I think that the story was told very clearly. I think the mayhem has come out of Christianity. I don't think that the story created Christianity. They act like they're all one. It's like I wish their doctrine did make them one, but Catholics don't accept Mormonism, and Mormons don't accept Catholicism, and all of the rest of them mixed together. So we do have, as you said, Barris, we do have a mayhem here. There's all of these external assumptions of things out there working things out for us. There is nobody and nothing out there working things out for us. What needed to be worked out was worked out at the cross. And that is where, like you say, the PR failed. It's interesting to note that Jesus himself intervened again after that to inspire the life of Paul. And I think he saw the PR was going really bad here. You know, the disciples who he openly said had no faith. And they never had any understanding. He never changed his mind about that. I can't find where it says he did. But yeah, it's been a bad rap for the gospel. The greatest travesty for the gospel has been that it became identified with Christianity. This is the point where everything changed. Now, at what point did it become identified with Christianity? I don't know. I know it first became how it first became to be people were called Christians, but it wasn't by Jesus. It wasn't by Paul. It was people were called Christians by those who were insulting the people of the way. But the issue is that the gospel got consumed in the structure of a religion rather than the gospel consuming the structure of religion. And that, to me, is what the gospel does. It consumes the structure of all religion. It literally devours all religion. It eliminates all religion. It eliminates all external spirituality. Please let me say that again. Will you?
Hey, Mike, would you say that again?
It eliminates all external spirituality, this internal God, this internal system, this internal, I mean, think of your computer, whatever you want to, this is all internal. This is the guts of the matter. It is God. It is a God-man now that exists. And there aren't, these are not two separate entities anymore. This is what has become.
Wait on now. There is no God as God was, and there is no us as
us was.
As us was. There is now a God us.
There is a us God.
Oh, us God. Us. Sorry. See, now right yes. there's a second denomination coming up. I'm in the God us, and you're in the us God. Of course, we use those blue song books, you know, the ones where the cover speaks of heaven. I see you're using those garish red ones that look just like hell. We baptize everybody. Not sure from the smell if you people baptize at all. And we're going to heaven. And you know that verse that says, what fellowship can light have with darkness? So, look, I'm sorry, that combined church barbecue you're talking about, that's out the window, mate. I can't see how that's ever going to happen.
I know. Well, you just got to change your mind, Barris. That's all the thing that has to happen here.
Oh, you mean repent and become one of you.
I repent see. And where become a Michaelist.
I am of Michael. I am of Barris. Okay. Now, in this chapter, you say that we were born sinners is simply not true. For 2,000 years, it has not been true because God imputed righteousness from the cross for every human being. It's because of the same logic and reason that everyone was a sinner, because of imputed sin, not because of what anyone did, but because of what God did. God imputed sin to the entire world. Could it be that this is why Christianity has invented things like the baby exception that we discussed last week? Could it be that although there's not a single intelligent reference in the Bible as to mentally retarded individuals and babies going straight to heaven if they die, in spite of David's claim that we're all born in iniquity, is it possible that all of us, Christians, Buddhists, and all of us, know in our hearts, know in our knower, that what you say here is really true?
My default is to believe that everybody already really knows this in their heart. Here, you've really brought up the crux of the matter. All of Christian doctrine is developed out of not accepting that everyone was made righteous at the cross. Every person that accepts that fact will no longer be a Christian. And if, Barris, if you really take Christian doctrine and look at it, Paul is the one that taught this first and last Adam theory, and sin being imputed by the first and righteousness being imputed by the last. But if that, let's take that as truth, and then let's say that a people who are trying to share the work of the cross do not accept it as truth. Let's say the cross took place, but people are still born in sin.
Uh-huh.
The doctrine that comes out of that is Christianity. The doctrine that comes out of that is the baby exclusion. The doctrine that comes out of that is the mentally handicapped exclusion. The doctrine that comes out of that is the, well, if they've never heard, God will explain it to them conclusion. Virtually all of Christian doctrine is based on the lack of acceptance, right or wrong, the lack of acceptance that no one is born in sin anymore. this is the very crux of Christianity in all of its manifestations. As far as gaining favor, losing favor, going to heaven, going to hell, being accepted, being rejected, getting your prayers answered, having them not answered, it all has to deal with whether or not this thing, this one thing, is true.
Now, first time I read through your book, the first time I read this chapter, or anything to do with the one man concept, I was confused. Because it's very difficult for me to get my mind around something which is not just a cow at a new gate sort of thing. I've also got these filters in my mind from my past, 6 decades of past Christianity filters that are saying, no, that's not true. But in fact, what you just said about Paul's theory about the one man, about sin being imputed to the whole planet through one man, righteousness being imputed to the planet through one man. I mean, it sure takes a lot of the guesswork out. It's very simple. I'm beginning to see that if Adam hadn't sinned, but if someone down the road did, then God would have had two distinct groups he'd have had to have worked with. But this way, he only had one group, or one man, if you please, and the whole plan could be the picture of simplicity.
I think that is the true picture, Barris, what you just said. To me, it's like a... if I were watching a scientist working with a virus, what is the first thing they want to do with that virus? Let's isolate it. Let's isolate the infection. Let's isolate the trauma. Let's isolate this. Once it's isolated, it can be dealt with. I think God's the greatest scientist and the greatest doctor that ever was, because he knew once sin took place, it was up to him to isolate it so that he could deal with it.
So you're saying whatever it was that is sin, this iniquity, this whatever it was,
yes,
he isolated it in one man.
In one man, he isolated it and put a quarantine on the virus. You can't go any further. You're not going to spread because of infection. You're going to spread because I impute it. But see, if God imputed the sin rather than man infecting man, infecting man, infecting man, then God still has only one man to deal with to get rid of the infection. Because by imputed sin, God is still dealing with isolated sin.
Mike, I think it's about time we defined what imputed means.
Well, the term imputed is very wonderful. It straightens out all of this stuff when you try to explain this to people, and they say, well, it's a gift, it's a gift. So we westernize the term gift, and I've had them stand there and hold their Bible out and say, here, I'll give you my Bible, and I don't put my hand out, and they drop it on the floor. They said, see, you didn't accept the gift. That means no matter how much I gave it, you didn't accept it. Don't you get it? And so that's where the term imputed gift becomes vitally important to our understanding, because the term imputed has nothing to do with the recipient at all.
Let me ask you this. Now, I'm an Australian citizen living in America. I may become a citizen of America. I may not, but I may. Is that imputation when they call me a citizen of the USA? Would I be imputed with that citizenship?
I think that would be correct. I've not really thought about it in that way. Of course, if you're going to become a U.S. citizen, you're going to have to earn it.
Uh-huh.
Right?
But I thought it was a gift.
We just don't let nobody in here. We don't let nobody's in here. You're going to have to earn this, dude.
Dang.
And
back to Wangaratta with me.
But yes, and in the concept that you are talking about, then it is some. I think the probably the most direct term to being imputed, it would be being born here. That is imputed for sure. But the issue, whether you become a citizen of this country by birth or because of immigration, it is imputed. There is nothing that you have to do then to be that citizen. There are things that a citizen ought to do, but it is imputed. Now, the term imputed works either way. It means to either have charged to or credited to your account without your participation. It works both ways. That's why the word imputed works perfectly for sin and for righteousness, because the term imputed does not imply good or bad. The term imputed describes the means by which something was passed from one to another. It is either charged against or it's credited to one's account. And in the first Adam, this was what was charged against every man's account. It was charged against us, and I think that wonderful thing that we were talking about, that was God isolating this this issue, this problem, this sin, until it could be dealt with. And I think he did.
So now, if the government suddenly decided tomorrow, and I think they should, to give everyone $10,000 because we had a wonderful budget surplus. Hang on, let me think of something else here. But if that happened, would that be imputed?
Yes. I remember when I got my $200 back during the Bush administration. So whether I liked it or not, that money was coming to me, yes.
So in Romans, where Paul is saying that God concluded us all to be in sin so that he could have mercy on all, could I rewrite it this way? Could I say, so God imputed us all with sin so that he could impute us all with righteousness? Could I say that?
Absolutely. It's a very good way to clarify it, actually. That all were brought into the condition so that all could be brought out of the condition. And this way, and by doing so, this isolation of the disease, if you will, the disease of sin, he isolated it so that by his own action, by imputing it, kept it isolated to where that sin would only be one issue when it had to be dealt with. All of the other things were given so that we could understand what the real issue was. And however, Christianity gets involved in the law and says that those are the issues.
You mean all those traditions and rituals and all of that?
That and the law itself, that the law somehow was a key to righteousness and holiness and relationship with God. The law was never given to make us right with God. It was never given to show us the way to do it right. The law was given simply as and truly and totally and completely and only and nothing less than a complete revelation of one sin, that regardless of how well you do it or how much you fail at it, the result of that conclusion is, wow, there must be a problem here that is bigger than me.
So the law was given to us not to make us guilty, but so that, like a litmus paper that I can dip in and see what the condition of a liquid is, I could actually take this litmus paper of the law, dip it into my behavior and say, oh dear.
There is a real problem here, and I thought the problem was what I was doing. But it turns out to be that when I measure it against what I should be doing and what I shouldn't be doing, there's got to be another problem here because this is not going to work out.
You're right here. At the moment of conversion, your sins are all going to be washed away. You're talking about what Christianity teaches. I know what that feels like, but you see, we all got shorted a bit. No, let me take that back. We got shorted a lot because we traded a total redemption for a partial salvation. Now, what you're saying, if I hear you right, is you're comparing redemption and salvation in total and partial. Tell me about that.
Salvation comes to the soul through the correct information. All the gospel is, it is no more and powerfully no less than the power of God. It is information, Barris. That's all it is. Oh my, how I would love to grab every spiritual brain and call in all of this crazy external spiritualizing of things and help people to understand the gospel is nothing more and profoundly nothing less than the power of God, but it is simply nothing more than information. That's all it is. Now, that information is for the saving of the soul, according to Paul's teaching, in the book of Romans. It is for the saving of the soul. So my soul is my mind and my will and my emotions. And God knows I've lived a life that I understand what the need of salvation is. The more Christian I became, the greater the need for salvation came to my mind and to my soul. It did not give me a greater salvation for my mind. It gave me less. So yes, for the statement that you read there in the book, it is very true that because of a lack of clarity about redemption, therefore I get cheated on the end of salvation for my mind, for my soul.
One of the very first things I remember, it might have been the second or third message that I ever heard of you a long time ago now, and you were talking about that verse that we love to quote, or Christians love to quote, and you hear it in every second prayer meeting, you hear it in the songs, and that is, "If I be lifted up, I'll draw all men unto me." Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at the Greek text, the word for men, anthropos, is not even in the Greek text. It was inserted, and the only way you can really confirm that easily in these modern times is simply to look at the introduction to any King James Bible. King James version of the Bible will say, now not a modern King James or the New King James, but the King James version, the 1611 mm-hmm. King James version, essentially the Bible, had a foreword which included this statement, that anything that was italicized were words that had been included. They weren't in the original text, but they were included for clearer understanding. Mm-hmm. And when you taught on this, you taught that what he was essentially saying was, I will draw all men unto me, but I will draw all unto mm-hmm. me. I will draw everything to myself.
Yeah, and the subject, of course, in the context of that was judgment. Now, I had someone point out to me that it wasn't only judgment, that it did include man also, which I have no problem with, that he drew, because at the cross, whether that verse contains it or not, we know that Paul's teachings in Ephesians brings it out very clear that he did draw all men unto or into him, and then at the very same time, he drew all judgment unto himself. So this cataclysmic, I'm telling you, the most loving, powerful thing that you can picture in your mind is Jesus seeing judgment coming upon all people. And at that moment, he gathered the entire human race, both Jew and Gentile, according to Ephesians, which was only two groups of people in God's eyes. And he gathered them into himself and received upon himself the judgment for all people. And not for their sins. Let's keep the continuity of this. This was not because these people had broken the law, because Paul made it very clear that the law never made a man a sinner. It was God who made man a sinner, at least after the first man. The first man became a sinner by his own volition, and then God took that sin and imputed it. So the only sin being dealt with at the cross was the imputed sin. The law, the breaking of the law, Jesus did. Oh, I would love so much to communicate this with a clarity that I think I lack, is that Jesus didn't die because you lied. Jesus didn't die because you stole. Jesus didn't die because you had sex. Jesus didn't die for any of these things. Now, Jesus died to take the law that held those things against you away, but he didn't die because you did that. Please understand me. Jesus didn't die because you were a bad person. That's what was taught to me in the Baptist church, and it took me to three attempts of suicide because I accepted what they said. And they said that not only did Jesus die because you did this and you did that, every time you do it again, you're crucifying him all over again, which is very strong, actually, Catholic doctrine that has been passed on to our Baptist friends. And that's what they told me. So I see these points are not doctrinal points for me, Barris. These are points of life for me. had somebody told me that Jesus didn't have to die because I was such a horrible person, I think I would never have had to face three attempts of suicide. I don't think I would have had to face six terms in a mental institution. But because Jesus died for me being bad and I couldn't stop being bad, it led to mental and emotional illness. I've said this many times, and I'll say it again. The only people who survive Christianity are those who really aren't paying attention.
Now, we know that if the church thinks badly of you, then obviously God must think badly of you. If the church rejects you, then God rejects you. If the church accepts you, then obviously God must accept you. Or at least if we don't know this, this is the mindset we come away with. And when the church finds my behavior less than outstanding, or in other words, sinful in their eyes, suddenly now God finds me unacceptable. And this is what you're saying led to three attempts at suicide.
This is the cancer of that. Absolutely. If there's anything that would describe a spiritual cancer, just like, you know, my our dear friend Richard Moll, who passed away with his cancer in his body, in the very same way, this is a spiritual cancer. It's something that feeds on life. It takes away life. It destroys life. It kills life.
Now, how does that compare with Jesus' words, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free? It doesn't sound so free to me.
Yes, that's because that's not the truth.
And now Paul says, so when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory.
Yes, kind of puts that in a past tense rather than a future tense. But see, here's the difficult thing we have. It is to accept that the mortal has put on immortality, and we are no longer corruptible. Oh my God, I can't be corrupted like the first man was. I can't go through that experience. I have no potential of becoming unrighteous. I have no potential of becoming unholy. I have no potential, not even a chance in hell could give me the potential for becoming corrupted by sin. It's not possible.
But you're saying that there is nothing for us to do now.
How about that? And this mortal has put on immortality too. Can it give stability to the brain? Oh my gosh. You know, before the modernization of electricity, you know how they had lines running from the iron to the light socket hanging above, and a line running around the back of the couch going over here to plug this in, and it was just wires everywhere. That was my brain. I had to try to bring a wire from over here to connect over here to get around the problem, which is nothing connects. But the salvation for the brain causes it to function on a whole different level. It is a brain function. The power of the gospel causes us to be able to think differently than any other way we have before. It is a process. I can't tell you when it starts, and I cannot tell you when it finishes. But you will know when it starts, and it will be going on throughout the rest of your life.
That sounds awfully like Jesus to Nicodemus when he says you can't know where the wind's coming from or where it's going.
Yeah.
And so the same is with everyone that's born of the Spirit. We've made that about the Holy Spirit, and it was really about us.
How in the world did we take something so out of context? When it hits you, you have no clue where that wind came from. And you know what? After that wind passes you, you have no clue where it's going. That's how much you're involved in being born of the Spirit. Pierce, we're not just talking about doctrines now. We're talking about what will cause the brain of a human being as a God-man to function and what will cause it to dysfunction. And Christianity and every other religion included is the source in America and around this planet is the source of dysfunction of the brain. The brain would be better off with no religion at all, no belief system at all. but you're going to have something there. My proposal is it might as well be good for you. It might as well be healthy for you. It might as well give your brain something to function on that will cause you to be a better you, the best you that you can possibly be.
You mean good news?
That is, in totality, what the gospel is. And I heard somebody say one time, there is no bad news in the good news.
Yeehaw.
A brilliant statement, I have to say.
Yeah. Whoever said that was one smart dude.
I'm telling you, my hat's off to him and my hair too.
Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Jumbo Corner, Michael.
Thank you, Barris. It's always good to be in this corner, that's for sure.
The Kenyan Corner with Michael Williams and Moses Garter from Kenya. And this week, Moses asks this question. When Jesus was talking in the four Gospels, he was talking to sinners. Does a verse taken from these books mean that that is what God is saying now? Was there good news in the account of Jesus in the four Gospels? Is good news about what Jesus was going to do or what he has done? Was there good news in the old covenant in which Jesus operated? Or didn't the good news come with the new covenant? How come he is talking the same words to the new creation today if we are to go with what the modern preachers are claiming, that the four Gospels account of Jesus is God talking to us today? Interesting question, Moses. What do you think, Mike?
The good news, as they are called, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gospels, what makes them good news? It's the cross that makes them good news. The inability to see Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in its proper view of before and after the cross, what is the good news of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? It's the cross. That is the account that is brought to us by them. It was the fact that the cross took place. That is the good news that is there. If you're going to try to find good news in Jesus' teachings, however, you're probably going to be sorely disappointed or extremely self-righteous, one of the two. Jesus eliminated every possible avenue that he ever met anybody with on any level for them to claim righteousness through their works. I made this statement many years ago, over 15 years ago, and I still hold to it, that if you want to lose all hope of redemption at all, the one place that you should never go to is to read the teachings of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. He disqualifies everybody. It doesn't make any difference who you are. He gets right down to the thoughts. It's not murder. Oh, no, you thought it was murder. You thought it was murder, didn't you? I'm telling you, if you even get angry, you're in great danger. You thought it was all about adultery, didn't you? Nah, sorry. It's not just about adultery. It's if you even think about it, you have committed the crime already. Jesus was not the bearer of good news. That really does sound weird, doesn't it?
Say it again. You say crazy stuff, mate.
Jesus was not the bearer of good news. Oh, goodness gracious. But the thing that Jesus died for produced the good news. So the good news, as they are called, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gospels, what makes them good news? It's the cross that makes them good news. And are those words for us today? They're there for us to understand that this all took place before the cross and what the cross actually meant. But that, to find that, we have to go back to the scriptures. Paul has a great deal of revelation in his teachings as to what this actually means. But no, I agree with you, Moses. Christianity has taken this completely out of context and really assaulted the human race I guess you can't assault someone with a lack of understanding, because that's exactly what has happened here.
Assault by ignorance.
Yes, it has been an assault by ignorance.
Jesus goes on to say, you guys are doing a wonderful job for humanity, especially in Africa and Kenya in particular. We're doing okay here in Kenya. The school of the scriptures is well and growing despite the oppositions here and there. And, of course, a big jumbo to all gospel revolutionaries everywhere. And jumbo to you, Moses, and everybody who's with you there at the school of the scriptures. Keep up the good work, Moses, and thanks for the questions. We love questions because questions are
the lifeblood of the gospel.
Also heard this week from, who is this? This is, this is Paul in the UK, Michael. And he said, can you explain exactly how the law in the Old Testament revealed people's sin condition? For instance, how does thou shalt not steal reveal man's condition of sin imputed from Adam? Thanks, Paul.
Wonderful question. The issue of the law revealing sin, I think, is brought out in Paul's revelation that came to him about the law in Romans chapter 7. How does the law reveal the sin condition? Paul said it like this: when everything that's in me wants to do right or obey the law, and every time, no matter how intently I want to keep the law, I break the law. And every time I try so intently to not do wrong, I don't find the power to keep from doing that. It just seems like I am stuck in a position that is unresolvable. And that's when Paul comes to this great revelation. Well, wait a minute. If I want to do good and I can't, and if I want to stop doing bad but I can't, there's a bigger problem here than me. I think the problem is not what I do, it's what I am. It is sin that dwelleth in me. It's not what I do, it's what I am. And who shall deliver me from this body of sin or this body of death? The law, it's just like the gospel, except on the other side of the cross. The gospel does not make anybody righteous. It reveals the righteousness that came through Christ. The law never made a man a sinner. The law simply reveals the sin that was imputed to man through the first Adam.
Is that what the scripture means when it says the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the heart? It changes me to understand what the problem really is.
Absolutely. And see, that's exactly Paul's experience. It changed his heart. It changed him from being a self-righteous person to gaining a revelation by accepting the fullness and the totality of the law. Paul came to this beautiful conclusion. I can't do it. No matter how much of a Pharisee of Pharisees I was, I could not measure up to the gains of the law and the requirements of the law. Therefore, I got this great revelation. Guess what? The problem is not what I do. It was something that was in me.
I ever have, mate.
It really does. That is the amazing thing about it, is that you begin to understand the effusiveness of Paul's comments later in the book of Romans. By the time you get into Romans 12 and get down to the bottom of that, Paul, I'm telling you, I love that. Of all of Paul's writings, you know, he is this very collected man. You really don't see Paul ever being very emotional from his teachings. He was just very clinical and methodical. But all of a sudden, he makes this statement that for God has concluded all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. And you're going to have to wade through at least three verses. And effusive is the only way you can describe it, of his absolute exaltation of Christ and what he has done. Oh, the wisdom of the greatness of the mightiness, and his ways are past finding out. And oh, thank God we've been delivered from that economy, which never worked. That economy, which never worked, was put away forever.
Forever. And that last verse, verse 36, says everything comes from him. Everything happens through him. Everything ends up in him. Always glory, always praise. Yes, yes, yes.
Paul, calm down, dude, okay?
Oh, not you, Paul. That Paul.
Yes, that's right.
Hey, and Paul in the UK, thanks so much for that question. That was a good one. Hey, listen, guys, send us questions that we can really get Mike worked up over. We want to release the wild East Tennessee side of this fella that you know as Mike Williams. So send us some good questions. These ones we got today are fantastic. Thanks, guys. And also from Facebook this week, Mike, Stacy Lovett Clark. I wish I had two names. My parents were mean in many ways, and that was one of them. Stacy Lovett Clark writes, can anyone help me make sense of Ephesians 6, 10 through 20? Now, this is, of course, a classic, putting on the whole armor of God part of what Paul writes. And she says, can you help us make sense of it? Now, when I read this on Facebook, I thought...
I am so sorry, Barris. I was not listening at all. Can you play that back for me?
I listened to the first part, and I was trying to think of something clever to say, and I totally didn't listen to you.
Okay, here we go. Pardon me. Stacey Lovett Clark writes, can anyone help me make sense of Ephesians 6:10-20? Now, this is a classic Pauline passage where he talks about the putting on the whole armor of God.
Even Paul and agreed with Jesus about having to return to the scriptures to understand all things. The interesting thing is that the prophecies about the armor of God is that Christ is the armor of God. When Paul is saying these things, he's trying to help us understand what took place, not what can take place. In other words, he's saying, don't just accept part of what Jesus did, accept it all. Take on the full armor of God, because the full armor of God is Christ himself. I remember, oh my gosh, that dude that came up with, could you not pray with me 1 hour? Oh, Lord. And so Norval got the big idea. Of course, the only way the prayer would work is if you started at 5 a.m. So Norval got so inspired. Norval was so inspired, he had me to do it. So... and I never said no to Norval. So he was so inspired by this guy that he had me to get up at 5 a.m. and lead the whole group in morning prayer, talking to the east, talking to the west, talking to the north, talking to the south.
You started that? We used to do that in seminary, mate. We were there at 5 in the morning, and let me tell you, I felt good afterwards. I felt like I'd really done something.
Oh, yeah. And you were tired, too.
Are you kidding me? If you're not tired in Christianity, then you're doing it wrong. I was always tired, and especially getting up 5 o'clock.
Yeah. And from there, you're just looking for a place to curl up and take a little nap. But, yeah, Norval's inspirations were always amazing to me. He'd get so inspired, he'd have me to do it. But that brings back a lot of really great memories, actually. But that's the issue with these entire subjects. The whole armor of God is Jesus. The whole armor of God isn't, I reach and I get my breastplate and I put my breastplate of righteousness on. I get my sword of the Spirit. I am not going to lay my sword of the Spirit down. I pick it up this morning. I put my shoes on of the gospel of peace. And we'd go through the whole thing and act it out.
Yep.
It's Christ. These aren't individual pieces. You know, well, you forgot your shield today. Well, I know what happened. You know, the devil got in because you forgot to go through putting on your shield. So that's why this has happened to you. I mean, it gives you so many excuses for trying to explain life rather than just accepting that life is life. And the fact of it is that we have put on Christ. And in our understanding, we are putting on Christ.
So, Stacey, what Paul was saying was, this is what you already have,
mm-hmm.
and not only have, but you are in Christ, who is all of this to you.
It's good preaching, Bears.
Well, thanks for the question, Stacey. Talking about Facebook, just was going through Facebook this week, and did you catch the Steve Essery's new movie?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you got to see it, mate. It's What is God's Policy Towards Those Who Hate Him? And he does such a good job. Good production on the little movie, too. It's up on YouTube, but he was kind enough to post it up on our page. And look, guys, go see this. Just go see the movie. It might be somewhere where you can send your friends. Oh, two people, James Taylor and Carla Barton, both posted a picture of a little boy with this quizzical look on his face. And he's turned to this adult and he's saying, you're saying my dead relatives are in hell for not believing in a God they didn't know existed?
Yes, these are things we need to be posting everywhere. Just you got to get a little dig into people's thinking, and I think that's an excellent way to do it. It's a good one.
Barry Laney writes, Michael Williams Ministries will hold the 2012 Southeast Gospel Revolution Conference September 29 through 30, Saturday and Sunday, two meetings each day, if this sounds like an ad, it is, at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. each day. Now, this will be held at the Cullman Civic Center in Cullman, Alabama. For more information, call Jeff Robertson at 352-569-4889. Thank you, Barry. And guys, why don't we see how many people we can get down to Coleman, Alabama? It's not that far from me, and I know that I think someone told me once that half the population of the United States lives within a half a day's drive of Nashville, where I am. So Coleman, Alabama, is not that much further. Well, hang on. Alabama goes all the way down to where the water gets wet stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it goes all the way down to the coast. We call it L.A., Lower Alabama.
L.A., I love it. Well, you've got Jeff Robertson's number there, and give us a buzz, because we would love to try and help you with ideas with accommodation and so forth. Thanks, Barry, for that. John Solomon. Wow, now there's a prolific poster I missed earlier. Seems to have some insights to Gnostic beliefs. He says, grace is a confirmation of who we are and what we deserve as God's children. Grace is the opposite of unmerited favor. As usual, religion has it upside down.
The statement that you just read from, that God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble, that is definitely the economy from before the cross. That is not after the cross. That is the system that Jesus did away with. That system is what was destroyed at the cross, that God gives favor to the humble and bestows grace upon the humble but resists the proud. That was the economy that existed before the cross.
You've got to keep listening to this until it really gets in. John, thanks for that. Gurma Colston wrote, we believe that everyone goes to heaven, but it isn't possible in this life to know the details about what our heavenly existence will be like after this life is over. I was quite touched by the whole post. That was just the first sentence of a long post. And it is true, isn't it, that Christianity paints a gorgeous picture of heaven. I mean, there are things that are in heaven, apparently, that the Bible hasn't even heard about.
I like Paul's description: to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, and that's everyone. But I think the reverse is also true. To be present in the body is to be present with the Lord. Whether we live, whether we die, we are the Lord's. We always put that on only one side because that's where Paul speaks of that. But Paul actually said that whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. It's all the same on either side of the cross as far as where the Lord is concerned. When I do take my last breath, I can't even fathom what Richard Mull is experiencing right now. I don't have a clue. I think the good news of the gospel makes me know that Richard is in no discomfort. He's in no pain. He is in the presence of absolute acceptance and in the presence of absolute love. Beyond that, I haven't a clue what that experience might be like, to not have your physical body with you and to be experiencing all these wonderful things. I really do believe it.
Danny wrote in a totally separate post, and I just thought it was interesting that I put these two together. He said, hell is a vacuum of burning beliefs which can only be dissipated by the recognition of the presence. And then he says this, if I make my bed in hell, you're there, and where you are is heaven. This is all I have to recognize. It's true. Wherever we go, he is there. Mm-hmm. Our Father is there. And wherever we are in Christ.
And that is, of course, a statement by David, who had a revelation of righteousness. And I think David was probably the only one of the Old Covenant who could have really made that statement with such clarity, because David is the one who had that exaltation in his revelation. Blessed is the man who has been made righteous, who hasn't done anything right. And blessed is the man who, when he does wrong, it's not imputed to him. So David had this incredible revelation, I think, therefore attributing to his understanding, no matter where he was, that God, he and God were together, because righteousness hangs out with righteousness, I guess you might say, in David's case. And when he said, if I make my bed in hell, the term there is not this fiery burning place. It literally just means the grave. Doesn't make any difference whether I go to the grave, doesn't make any difference whether I'm in the grave, out of the grave, where I'm at, wherever I'm at. I'm in the presence of God. It just doesn't make a difference. I think fully attesting to Paul's comments that we just covered.
Gurma and Joshua, thanks for those comments. In fact, thanks everyone for your comments on Facebook. Keep it living, will you? Keep it alive and keep the Look, I just want to say thanks so much for the energy that a lot of you put into this, Chris and Jeff and Mike yourself, and just if I start naming names, I'm going to miss someone out, and then I'm going to get a nasty letter from my mate over in Arizona, and he's going to ask why I left him out. So, guys, thanks so much for Facebook, and thank you so much for keeping it real and keeping the questions going.
Ba-do-da-da. Listen in your office, in your car, or even your neighborhood bar. You can listen with your whole family. Do-a.
When you're feeling down or you got the case of the blues, why don't you listen to the Gospel Revolution?
Well, it had to happen. Michael finally wrote a chapter that we just couldn't finish in 1 hour. So tomorrow we'll be releasing part two of this Gospel Powercast. And let me tell you, if you thought part one was good, you ain't heard nothing yet. This is the end of part one of this Gospel Powercast.